ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौघ्नक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ Let there be peace and harmony everywhere. Om peace, peace, peace. This is the third session. Today, we are going to deal with a very, very interesting aspect of this Vedanta philosophy. Yesterday mentioned that Advaita philosophy teaches us that we can have this highest spiritual experience in this life, even in the midst of our everyday activities, and continue practicing what we have been doing. So I gave the example of Vyatha. Of course, there are many such illustrations in the traditional literature. There is an interesting verse in the Kathopanishad itself. Those who are interested perhaps can remember, it's the 14th verse of the third valli, third section. The verse is Uttishtada Jagrada Prapya Varan Nibodhada Kshurasya Dhara Nishida Durettiya Durgam Padastat Kavayo Vadanti. This is the famous verse. In fact, it is so profound and so celebrated a verse that Vivekananda considered this as his motto for spiritual awakening, because this contains the essence of the psychology of spiritual awakening and also the psychology of spiritual slumber. That what it refers to. Because you should be deep asleep, then only you can awake, come to the waking stage. So the verse is this one, Uttishtada Jagrada Prapya Acharyan Prapya Nibodhata Kshurasya Nishita Dhara Durettiya Tatha Tatpatha Durgam Kavayaha Vadanti. It means, according to great sages and saints, this path is very difficult to tread, to take. Very narrow and like the sharp edge of a knife. So you have to get up, you have to awaken from your spiritual slumber. And then you have to approach somebody. You know, for every science, you need a teacher. Unfortunately, there is a wrong notion in many of the non-confirmative social circles. The so-called extra-liberal circles, that for spirituality, you don't need a teacher. For every other science, you need a teacher. To become an expert barber, to become an expert gardener, an expert cook, a teacher, a professor, you need a teacher. For spirituality, everyone can begin as a teacher. You don't have to be a student. So you don't go to a kindergarten or a school or a college to learn spirituality. That's the only science which you can assume as if you have already become a teacher. But this verse tells you, Varan Nibodhata. So Varan actually means acharya and teacher. You have to approach somebody. So to learn something, you should first of all approach somebody who has already learned it. Because, you know, you cannot transmit the flame of a lamp from one lamp to another lamp if there is a millimeter gap. They should come together. Then only the light can be transmitted from one lamp to another lamp. That's why the great commentator Shankaracharya says, Anadi vidya prasupta uttishtada he jantavaha. So those who are spiritually asleep, he calls them jantu. Jantu means just living beings. It is not an invective. It is just a statement of the real fact. unless we are spiritually awakened, so long as we are spiritually in deep slumber, we cannot really be called enlightened thinking human beings. That was his view. So he says, an atmajnana abhimukha bhavata. So you have to orient yourself towards your spiritual goal. I mean the journey towards immortality. And he says, jagrata, be alert and awakened. Anadidraya ghora rupayaha sarva anartha bija bhudayaha kshayam kuruta. So this sleep, this spiritual sleep, is the cause of all problems. So yesterday we discussed the difference between the concept of the origin, I mean the doctrine of the theory of evil in Abrahamic traditions and the theory of error in Vedantic tradition. Ignorance is the cause of all problems in Vedanta. The devil or the Satan is the chief mischief maker in non-Vedantic traditions. Also in non-Vedantic Indian theistic traditions also, there is some sort of a rival for God sitting somewhere, lurking in the corner, to attract those who are turning towards God, come this way, you know. So, but Vedanta says it is not a devil, it is our ignorance. So, Shankaracharya says, you have to get up from this slumber of ignorance. This ignorance is explained in a very dramatic language in another famous scripture, which actually describes what this spiritual sleep is all about. So it says in the Mandukya Karika, see, anadi mayaya supto yatha jiva prabuddhide ajam anidram asopnam advaitam vidyade tatha. So we are all spiritually asleep. Even when we are working hard 24 hours of the day, making billions of dollars, having the best of jobs, friends, the best reputation, still we are not awake, we are asleep in a spiritual sense. And you can be spiritually very much awake when you are aware of your true nature. So, spiritual waking state and empirical waking state are two conditions, you know. One can be spiritually deep asleep even when he is awake in a very material sense. So we are all deep asleep. Now, first of all, the first condition for waking up is that you should be aware of the fact that you are asleep. This is not true in the ordinary concept of sleep, you know. A sleeping man is not aware of the fact that he is asleep. But in the spiritual life, the first condition is that you should be aware of the fact that you are not awake. In the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, in a very simple language, Sri Ramakrishna says, you know, it's an illustration from catching fish. Now, when you catch fish, a lot of fish may jump out of the net. Some fish may be clever enough not to get trapped. And some fish could be stupid enough to interpret the captivity as a state of liberation. So that's what Sri Ramakrishna says. He's caught, the fish is caught, going to be eaten, but he says this is very wonderful, absolutely a blissful state. It's only for a few minutes it will be eaten. So that is a kind of spiritual slumber. The fish that is clever enough can take care of itself without being trapped and caught by the fisherman. But there are a few who suddenly realize, oh, I'm asleep, so I should awaken, and just jumps out of the net. So the first condition for a spiritual awakening is the realization of the fact that we are right now not in the best of conditions. We will illustrate this point in the light of an illustration from another great scripture. It is from Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. We'll come to that. So the commentator says, and he calls this spiritual sleep ignorance as sarvanartha bija bhuta. I mean, that is the root cause of all problems. Sarvantaram atmanam ahamasmedi nivodada avagachada nahi upekshadavyam iti sruti anukampaya aha matruvat. So, just as a loving mother gives a warning to a child who is heading for a precipice, for trouble, no, don't go that far, that way. Take a different route. Like that, this Vedantic scripture, like a loving mother, just gives a warning, nahi upekshitavyam, don't give up this spiritual awakening, this path to spiritual awakening, what is called path to immortality. So now, this is explained in the light of a very interesting story that comes in the it comes in the Chandogya Upanishad, in the 6th chapter, which deals with, just got altogether 16 sections called Brahmanams, the Chandogya Upanishad. In the 14th Brahmanam, 14th section of the 6th chapter, there is an interesting illustration. It comes in the middle of the exposition of the famous Upadesha Mahavakya. It's called Tattvamasi. Very, very famous, absolutely very celebrated portion of the Vedic literature. So there, in the 14th Brahmanam, there's a story. It is an illustration, so it is called the Gandhara Purusha Drishtanta. I mean the illustration of a great spiritual truth in the light of an example. The example is the example of a pilgrim who was returning to Gandhara, today's Kandahar in Afghanistan, from India. After learning Vedas, he was returning as a pilgrim. There was a land route. Even Afghanistan was part of India, India's spiritual culture. In fact, it was a cradle of many of these Vedic traditions. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there are references. Ete sarve gandhara desiyaha brahmanaha agataha, you find in the Bhashyakara says, great scholars, sages, saints coming from where? Kandahar. Today's Afghanistan. It's a part of India's Vedic heritage. Anyway, so the illustration is this. Somebody had come from Kandahar to India, and after undergoing Vedic education, is returning back home. On the way, he was ambushed, and he was dragged to the thick forests, tied to a tree, blindfolded, and he couldn't move, he couldn't speak. All his possessions robbed. Now, what should he do? He should try to make some noise, because he is tied to a tree in the thick forests, very close to the main road that would have taken him to his hometown. Suppose he stands there, I am in a very wonderful, happy situation. I am tied to a tree, blindfolded, and I can't move. All my possessions gone, and maybe he may have received a few blows also, because robbers won't treat their victims so kindly. So along with possessions, he would also must have been assaulted. Suppose he thinks that I'm in a very happy condition. That's the state of people who consider money, wealth, status, and material comforts as the ultimate value in their life. I'm in a very happy condition. Very often people need some blows to force them open their eyes. The intelligent person is he who won't receive or wait for the blows to come. On the other hand, an intelligent person will seek out these great spiritual truths. So what happened? This poor pilgrim, he was blindfolded. Blindfold corresponds to say kind of ignorance, looking upon material pleasures, sensual pleasures as the ultimate end. It's kind of delusion, maya, enjoyment, obsession with sense pleasures. This forest is his body, and these thieves are his temptations. Now, do we consider our body to be forest to be got out of? Do we consider our body to be something alien to us? But this human body can be a very wonderful thing for us. It can be a wonderful spiritual mechanism. You know, one of the greatest Sanskrit poets of all times in India was Kalidasa, there's a well-known verse in one of his dramas, Malaviga Agnimitram. It was translated in 18th century into German, the first English European language into which it was translated. And Schopenhauer and others refers to that. So there is a well-known verse. It is a Kalidasa says, Yavvanam dhana sambatti prabhutvam dhanamevacha ekaikamabhi anarthaya kimu yatra chadushtagam. So youth, energy, a lot of friends, maybe sycophants because he's rich, and of course wealth, reputation, all these can be a cause of one's downfall. Even one is enough to cause downfall without some kind of spiritual wisdom. Youth, healthy body, all material pleasures can be a blessing if along with that we have a discerning wisdom. I mean a sense of proportion, wisdom that helps us to make proper use of these gifts of nature and avoid making improper use of them. Otherwise, yavvanam dhana sambatti prabhutvam, all this can be a serious problem. It can lead people to downfall. But then along with this spiritual wisdom, it can be a great blessing also. That's why the same Kalidasa in another verse, it is called in Kumara Sambhava, he says, Sariramadhyam khalu dharma sadhanam. He says, Api kriyartham sulabham samit kusam jalani visnana vidhikshamanite api sushaktiya tapasi pravartase sariramadhyam khalu dharma sadhanam. The Kumara Sambhava, the fifth sarga, Kalidasa says, it's a dialogue which I'm not going deep into because that will take us out of the context. Shiva trying to test the devotion of his devotee asks the question, are you engaged in all these austerities by your own strength, or do you have all these facilities, you know, for practicing these austerities? Don't torture your body. Body is a wonderful instrument. Adhyam means mukhyam, according to Sanjeevani commentaries. No? Means, is a commentary on the Kumara Sambhava. Means, adhyam means mukhyam. The most important instrument for practicing dharma is this body. The same body, when we get attached to it, when we become obsessed with it, and when we become obsessed to spiritual sensual pleasures, then this body, bodily attraction, can be the cause of downfall. So it's a wonderful instrument. Body, mind, intelligence, efficiency, this is modern science and technology. All can be wonderful if properly used by a wise person with wisdom. Otherwise, it can be self-destructive. Now, the point is, this man, coming back to the pilgrim, you know, the pilgrim, he recognizes this fact, this reality, that this is a state of bondage. So even when we have the best of this world, to be able to look upon it as a bondage, as a state of imperfection, it needs some kind of wisdom to recognize the fact bondage is bondage. The pilgrim had the wisdom to recognize the fact that he was not in the best of conditions. He was dragged, tied to a tree, blindfolded, he couldn't move. So what should he do? He should make a lot of noise, whatever noise he wants to make. So that may attract the attention of other passers-by who are taking the same road. And they may listen to this noise coming from the thick forest, may approach him, untie the rope, liberate him from bondage, and bring him to the main road, and show him, you take this road, and you get back to your hometown. That's what exactly happened. That's how to realize the spiritual awakening. The recognition of the fact that there is something higher than artha and kama. Recognition of the fact that there is something higher than material pleasures, enjoyments, empirical pleasures. There is a higher end. That recognition, the realization of this fact, will help us to enjoy this world in a more intelligent manner. One can live in this world without belonging to this world, without being of this world. So this pilgrim had the wisdom. He recognized he was in a state of spiritual slumber. So he made a lot of noise. So another passerby who was taking the same road heard this noise coming from the thick forest, approached him, removed him, untied the ropes and brought him the main road. And now you take this road and you will get back to his hometown, Gandhara. This illustration. So this is what happens to a spiritually enlightened person. First of all, he should recognize that there is something higher than money, wealth, status. They are needed. We should not misinterpret Vedanta as some sort of an extreme kind of life-negating, world-negating asceticism. That is totally wrong. Vedanta takes into account, it accommodates all possible human values, the realities of empirical life, the things of this world, but then going beyond them. That's the idea. That's the very concept of Rajashi, Rajanastha Rishesha Rajasheha. What is the highest ideal that is preached in the Karma Yoga context of Bhagavad Gita? You can be a king, efficient, live in this world, and realize the needs and demands and dreams of this world, but still keep your mind fixed on some higher transcendental ideal. So, one of the commentators on this makes a very interesting, it's a very, very revealing, you know. Says Rajatvam Aishwarya Sambhatti Rishitvam Tasyaha Sokshmasa Dasyanakshamatvam. It's a Sanskrit quotation, but it's a very deep, profound idea. Rajatvam, the state of a king, nothing but it is just a more profound philosophical analysis of Plato's concept of a philosopher king. He expounds in the Republic. The same thing. You can be a king. You can be successful in this world. You can be an efficient CEO, have the best of this world. But at the same time, you should have the mind of a sage. So what is the importance? What's the relevance? What is the importance of being saintly at heart and kingly without? The idea is this. We must have all these things in material pleasures, enjoyments, but for calling Sanskrit, the three first values, artha and kama, supported by dharma. But then, we should also be able to recognize the limitation of efficiency, the limitation of success, the limitation of prosperity. Once we understand the limitation of Rajatvam, kingliness, efficiency, money, wealth, worldly success. Once we understand that it does not, cannot bring lasting peace, there is something higher than that, and then you pursue that path, then we can be a philosopher at heart and a king without. This is the ideal behind. So, this is how we attain the spiritual awakening. Now, this is illustrated in very, very interesting illustration. It's from another Upanishad. But before that, I just want to refer to another verse in the Kathopanishad itself. Ashabdam, asparsham, arupam, avyayam, tatha arasam, nityam, agandhavachayat, anadyanandam, mahataparam, dhruvam, nichayat, and mirtimukatramuchade. So how do you liberate yourself from the clutches of death? Death doesn't mean physical death. Death here means looking upon this body, these worldly pleasures, as the ultimate end, ultimate goal. That's what it means. So the illustration is given in another very, very famous verse. It comes in the Mundaka Upanishad. It's also in the form of an illustration which I mentioned yesterday. It is this: Dva Suparna Sayuja Sakhaya Samanam Vriksham Parishu Sajate Tayoratti Anyam Pippalam Swadatti Anasnin Anyu Abhichaka Siti Samane Vrikshe Purusho Nimagno Anishaya Shojadi Mukhyamana Justam Yada Paschit Anyamisham Asya Mahimanam Idi Vita Shoka. This is the verse. You need not worry if you don't follow the Sanskrit verse. I shall explain and expand the meaning. It is simple. Think of a tree, and there are two birds, very friendly to each other, and they look alike. There's no difference. Now, there is one difference between these two birds. The bird sitting on the branch above and the bird sitting on the branch below. They look alike, and they belong to the same species. The only difference is the one sitting on the branch below goes on eating fruits. And you cannot have sweet fruits all the time. Occasionally, it eats sweet fruits and also bitter fruits. Just like human beings living this world. We cannot expect to have success, enjoyment, gain all the time. It's like expecting a coin with only one side. We cannot have a coin with only one side. So, if we go on eating sweet fruits, then there will come a time when another fruit happens to be bitter. So the question arises, how to eat sweet fruits all the time? That question has no answer. Going beyond sweetness and bitterness is the only answer to go beyond bitterness. So if anyone wants real enjoyment, then one should stop looking for enjoyment. So enjoyment has two dimensions in Gita. One is the ordinary enjoyment, you know, when you get something that you aspire for, it makes you happy and satisfied. That's fine. When you get something opposite, you become unhappy. So when you get something today, you are happy, and you become unhappy when you lose that tomorrow. This is natural at the empirical level. Now going beyond that, if there is another kind of sukham, it is called sukham atyantikam yatat buddhigrahim atyendriyam. A kind of sukham is to be called blissfulness, inner contentment, that goes beyond the empirical enjoyments and the empirical miseries. When you understand what it means, you are able to look upon pain and pleasure, enjoyment and grief with the same equanimity of mind. So you transcend both. So, according to spiritual teachers, this is actually the picture of the human soul in its journey. Yesterday I mentioned two types of journey. One journey, the path of Abhyudaya, Preya. The other one, the path towards Shreya or Nisreyasa, Nivritti, whatever it is. So these are Sanskrit terms, which means one path directly in pursuit of the highest spiritual goal. The other one, without bothering about that, having good things of this world, artha and kama, enjoyments, pleasures, everything. Of course, you need some kind of a discipline, so dharma cannot be discarded. Now, the point is, the bird below doesn't recognize the fact that it should stop looking for fruits, sweet fruits all the time, if it wants to avoid bitterness. It doesn't recognize that fact. If you recognize the fact that the only way to avoid bitterness is to stop looking constantly for sweet fruits. So we should stop looking for happiness all the time if we want to avoid unhappiness. So that's a point here. So slowly the bird below looks at the other bird. There's no difference between the two. Samane vrikshe, the same body, you know, in our body, the same body. We have one person undertaking a spiritual journey, another person moving the opposite direction. That's why when we take to spiritual life, when we start meditation and prayer, we find a secondary personality seems to emerge. The first Western psychologist to point out is Jung himself, you know, modern man in search of a soul. You find, when you take to spiritual life, when you try to meditate, or even when you read a wonderful book, spiritual classic, suddenly a desire emerges in the mind. Well, I must bring about a change in my habits. And I must discipline my ways of my lifestyle, and bring about a change in my overall paradigm of my life. It's a sincere desire. But then when you really start to practice it, mind suddenly becomes a stumbling block. It's a mental block. The vrittis, vasanas, samskaras, impressions, attitudes, characteristics, we are accumulated in the mental system, suddenly come to the surface, creating a mental block. It doesn't permit the secondary personality to emerge. The second personality is the goal. The first personality is what we already are. If one persists, slowly you will find the first one will merge with the second one. That's what this bird imagery illustrates. So the point is, at one point in our life, we get a vision of the beyond, a vision, a remote glimpse of some higher ideal. This could happen when you listen to a very wonderful lecture, or when you meditate, or when you read a great book. I can give the example. One classic illustration which I referred to earlier was the pilgrim in the way of a pilgrim. The pilgrim is a story which I have referred to many times in these sessions. The story, it's taken from a very marvelous, absolutely matchless mystical work. It's called The Way of a Pilgrim, from Russian mystical literature. A pilgrim, he was a rustic villager who was hardly literate. One day he went to a church and he listened to the first epistle of St. Paul during a sermon, where St. Paul refers to the state of being always in a prayerful mood, the Jesus prayer, the origin, the real first reference, genesis of it. So he listened to this sermon. Maybe the preacher didn't care what he was talking about. But this poor illiterate peasant took it very seriously. And it created a lasting impression on his mind. He left his home. He was a poor man. Put all his belongings in a haversack in some kind of he didn't have much belongings, of course. And he started his journey in search of somebody who could teach him the mystery of Jesus' prayer. And eventually he met a monk, and the monk took him to a cell, his cell in the Russian Orthodox monastery, and taught him Jesus' prayer. So, what happened? When he heard the sermon, suddenly he saw before him on the distant horizon, he got a vision of the beyond, something that he should aspire for. And he didn't stop it. So in life also, frequently, many spiritual seekers, when they read a book, or when they listen to a lecture, when they pray, suddenly they feel, they get a distant vision of, not a very clear vision, of something higher, something transcendental, something they should aspire for. It is something beyond the life of the senses, beyond the immediate surroundings. But then what happens? Frequently we may forget it and get back to our old ways. Again, we may again get this. Now, like that, this bird sitting on the branch below saw and looked at the bird above, and it found the bird above, on the branch above, was sitting calm and quiet. It was not eating anything. Anasnan anyo apichakasi. It was not eating anything. So it was free from all sorrows, all problems. Because it was not seeking happiness, it was never unhappy. It was not looking for happiness, so it never became unhappy. So now this bird sitting on the branch below wanted to be like the other bird. So it moved forward. The moving forward is not mentioned in the Upanishad proper, but in the commentaries it comes. And Swami Vivekananda also had adopted that particular interpretation. The bird sitting below, seeing his friend, cousin, the same, said, you know, you may find one of your cousin has become an ambassador, that you also want to be like that, you know. You're getting law grade, and your close friend is moving ahead to Harvard, you also want to go there. So this bird below wanted to be like the bird above, to sit with calmness, serenity, and peace. So it slowly moved forward. When he reached the branch above, they became one. So again, you have to refer to the old story. When we pray, we get the vision of the bird sitting above. The second personality emerges. But the contradiction, the difference still persists. As we go ahead persisting in spiritual practices, then what happens? Slowly we open our eyes, and this is how spiritual awakening happens. When the bird sitting on the branch below becomes one with the bird sitting above. This is the psychology of spiritual awakening. This is possible only by spiritual practice. Yesterday I mentioned again and again, Vedanta is not an idea, it is not a concept, it is a state of spiritual evolution. So it is a state of spirit, it's a spiritual state that you reach, that you experience, not a condition that you read about or a concept that you accept. You become a Kantian if you teach critical pure reason. You become a utilitarian when you teach or when you read J.S. Mill or Bentham. You become an evolutionist if you swear by Darwin. It's not like that. You become a Vedantin when we get a fraction of this experience. So to emphasize that point, this Upanishad has got another very important verse, indeed the 23rd verse of the second section. He says, Nayamatma pravachaneya lebhyo nemethaya nebhuna sutena yamaivesha runudetena lebhyatasesa atma vivrunudetanum siyat. Now the point is, this realization cannot be attained through scholarship, through book knowledge, not even by intellectual power. Na methaya mean grandha dharana shakti. That is the meaning of it. So how do we realize this? Through constant spiritual practice. As I mentioned earlier, intellectual power is necessary. It helps you to go beyond itself. Shankaracharya makes it very interesting. The greatest philosopher of India tells you that philosophy is nothing. That is the greatness. The one who wrote all the commentaries on the Upanishads tells you that these Upanishads alone cannot take you to the highest spiritual experience. If anyone has an authority to say that it is Shankara alone. So it says, Nayamatma Pravachanena Lepyaka. So he himself states, you know, Vaikari, Shabda Chari, Shastra Vyakhyana Kaushalam, Vaidushyam Vidusham Tadvat Bhuktaye Natu Muktaye. So scholarship, all these things are necessary, but then they alone cannot take you to the highest spiritual experience. All scholarship, all book knowledge have one great positive purpose: to remove wrong notions. So you know, when there is a rope in the room, when you bring light, the light doesn't give away darkness. When that is done, that is accomplished, the rope is automatically revealed. It is self-revealed. Some people may say, oh, the light, when you switch on the light's revealed rope. No. Without the help of the rope will be rope. It cannot become anything else. It cannot become serpent or anything. When you bring light, the light's role is limited to removal of darkness. Like that, all scholarship, all important scriptural readings are very important. Without them, we cannot really enter Vedanta. That's true. First of all, you should have an idea of what you should reach, what you should attain. So that's why he says, Shastram tu ajnana nivartakam na jnana pravartakam. Scriptures remove wrong notions, do not bring knowledge. You'll be shocked here. Scripture, that's a very, knowledge here means the highest realization, not book knowledge or objectified cognition. That's an important point to remember. So, he says, by intellect, by scholarship, book knowledge alone, we won't get this this realization. Because reason needs discipline. Our intellectual faculties need some discipline. Otherwise, intellectual faculties can themselves become a problem. You know, Yepuman Adhimedhavi Chaturnam Ekamasnudhi, it's mentioned here. Alpayu Anabadru Anabatyova Daridra Paditopiva, it's mentioned, sorry, in the scriptures. Those who are highly gifted intellectually, if they don't have a spiritual foundation, they may be looking for, heading for trouble. So, because intellect not guided by appropriate wisdom that you get from scriptures is like a wheel that go on rotating, you are not able to come out of this wheel. On the other hand, intellectual powers guided and refined by proper education, a proper understanding of scriptures, is like a straight line. At the end of it, you go beyond itself. So one of Shankaracharya's tasks was, he was expounding all these great scriptures, the great logical powers, to teach us the limitation of scriptures and the limitation of logic. That's why the Upanishad tells, this highest realization is not possible without proper training and without spiritual practice. Towards the end of the fifth section, the Upanishad has got a wonderful statement. With that we conclude, because a fairly long Upanishad, and to expound this in three sessions is inconceivable. So anyway, shall read one verse. Na tatra suryo bhadi, na chandra taragam, nema vidyato bhandi, kutoyam agnihi, tameva bhantam anubhadi sarvam, tasya bhasa sarvamidam vibhati. In this realm of Atman, the highest realization, there is no sunlight, no moonlight, nothing. It is self-effulgence. So in the Upanishadic tradition, this Atman is frequently interpreted as the light of all lights. It is called Jyotisham Jyoti. So light doesn't mean this light. Light means what reveals everything, what gets revealed in his presence, that is light. So there is a very famous section in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it's called Jyoti Brahmanam. It's called a discussion between a king and a sage. The king also is a great saint, it's a philosopher, King Janaka, and Yajnavalkya, who is a great teacher, great acharya of those days. It's a discussion. I am not going to details because we have just about 5 minutes. Now there, the king puts one question to his friend, the great philosopher Yajnavalkya. What is the light that helps you in your everyday activities? That's the question. I mean, what light helps you to do your work, do your duty? To go about duties and responsibilities. It's an ordinary simple question. In fact, the dialogue appears to be very, very pedestrian, very simple at the early part of it. But to the end, it becomes a very profound, spiritual, philosophical discussion. Well, sunlight helps you. Suppose there is no sunlight. Then he says, well, there is no moonlight. Surya Jyoti, Chandra Jyoti. Suppose at night there is no sunlight, moonlight. Suppose there is no sunlight nor moonlight, what light helps you? It is maybe you light a candle, fire, Agni Jyoti. Well, suppose you are in a dark room, there is no light, and you can't see or hear or know anything with the help of any kind of light. Light as we understand at empirical level means sunlight, moonlight, or candle, Surya Jyoti, Agni Chandra Jyoti, or Vak Jyoti. This is what we normally understand by light. Well, at that time, the answer given by Yajnavalkya was this: Vak Jyoti. You listen. Well, suppose you are in a room, you can't see anything, dark room. How do you how do you understand there is a vehicle moving the street? A sound comes from the street, and through your ear you hear the noise, a Vak Jyoti. Or you may speak, and somebody may come to know of the fact that you are there. That's okay. But suppose you are in a room, there is no, in a dark room at midnight, and you can't, there is no sunlight or moonlight, and you are tired. By God's grace, such a situation won't arise to anyone, but let's think of the illustration, you know. You are bound hand and foot, and you can't speak, a tape over your lips, you can't see. Still, you are not totally inactive. You still, something goes on within your system. You may remember what happened yesterday. You may remember what happened 10 years back. You can visualize what you saw in the past. Memories and dreams, all these can happen with Vedanta. In Vedanta, both Smriti and Swapna belong to the same category. So in your mental system, you can walk in the streets of San Francisco, though your eyes are closed. You can hear voice, your own voice, because memory helps you to re-experience audio experiences in the past, like visual experiences through memories. So how does it happen? What is the light within you which is still there? Though there is no sunlight, no moonlight, no candle and no Vagjyoti either. So Atma Jyoti. So Atma Jyoti, that is Jyotisham Jyoti, the light of all lights. So light here means the great revealer in whose presence everything gets automatically revealed. Without Atman being present in us, we won't be able to see anything. Even in the broad daylight, we won't be benefited by the sunlight or moonlight or lamp or anything. All other lights, four lights, they get their ability to reveal other things from Atma Jyoti. So, it is this Atma Jyoti that is the light of all lights. And this Atman is present as the immanent indweller in all beings. Yesterday we discussed Anoraniyan Makato Mahiyan Atma Sijanto Hu Nihidam Guhaya. So, it is immanent as the indweller Antaryami in everyone. Once we recognize this, we will realize our true nature. And once we realize this true nature, we get spiritually awakened. That's the way of realizing spiritual awakening, in fact. Before this, as I mentioned earlier, like the bird sitting on the branch below, when he had a vision of the other bird sitting above, slowly it developed a desire to be like the other bird, just sitting quite happy and contented because it was not looking for sweet fruits, it did not have to eat bitter fruits. So, once we stop looking exclusively for sweet fruits, then we will be able to look upon bitter and sweet fruits with the same equanimity of mind. Even as a concept, this idea will be of great help, even at the very, very practical level. No matter what profession we are practicing, what work we are engaged in, this will be a great help. So now we will have interaction for about half an hour. And after that, of course, you know, we will have tea and then meditation and conclusion. Okay. We will have interaction.
Swami, in Vedanta, can you describe the difference, or how Vedanta explains the difference between eternal life and immortal life?
Eternal life and immortal life?
Yes.
Okay. Eternal life is a concept in Christian tradition, where you reach heaven, you live in the celestial world, in the company of angels. It's the same thing as immortality, but there's a little difference. This concept of eternal life is found in all non-Advaitic traditions of India. La Vaishnava, Shakta, all traditions where the spiritual, these devotees reach the particular world in which their particular deity lives in close proximity with them. This idea is there. But in Advaita, non-dualistic philosophy, you realize your nature. You don't have to go heaven somewhere, you go towards yourself. You come back to your home. You don't go to heaven, you come to yourself. That's the main difference. So, there is a little qualitative difference, of course, in this matter. In non-dualistic system, you don't go anywhere. Rather, you realize where you actually are, where you actually belong. So, once you realize, I am not this body, I am not this mind, I am not even this intellect, I am not this senses or anything, I am something that goes far beyond all this, I am the Atman, I am the transcendental reality, that's my true nature. So you don't go anywhere. That alone can be immortal. The other one is something you attain. What you attain may not be everlasting. What you actually are, it can be everlasting. See, our own home we don't change. Even when we go to heaven, it's like going to a very luxurious place. You leave your home behind and you go there, which may not be yours. That's why in the non-Advaitic traditions, very often their deities can get angry with them. So why in the Bhagavata Purana, Jaya Vijaya, Vishnu's servants were expelled from Vishnu Loka, Vishnu's heaven. This happens in all traditions. But yet nobody can expel you from yourself. That alone can be truly immortal. So that's an interesting. Remember, Advaita or non-dualism doesn't deny monotheistic traditions, either Indian monotheistic traditions or Abrahamic monotheistic traditions. Only Advaita tells you beyond this, this is the thing. So after eternal life, you reach immortal life. So that's why Vedanta, this Vyadha story yesterday I gave. This man practiced austerities for decades in a forest, in a mountain region. That's what Mahabharata says. And then, of course, he was born in a family where they were practicing this profession, you know. Unfortunately, India, like a trade guilds of Europe, medieval times, you know, the same trade they practice for generations. So this man, he, after realizing the highest spiritual truth, he did not demand a promotion in his profession. He went back to his profession. But his whole attitude was different. Even while cutting meat, he was expounding Vedanta. To whom? To an ascetic. So you can imagine. So where did he go? He didn't go anywhere. He came back to himself. So immortality means you coming back to your true nature. You come back to your real your own self, capital letter. Yes, that's what it is. Yes.
Yeah. Namaste. The story of the birds, the sweet fruit and the sour fruit.
Yeah.
So how does a positive mindset work in this? So if I'm not looking for a sweet fruit, I'm concerned I may be not so positive, right? So how do we manage that?
Yeah, I can give an example from the Vaishnava tradition of Ramanuja. So, Udara Sarvayavai, there is a statement in the Gita. Anyway, the subject is, according to Ramanuja, which is a system of philosophy, Visuddhadvaita, we evolve from Dvaita to Visishtadvaita and then Advaita. You can't say that one path is wrong. It is one way to reach the higher thing. After reaching Harvard, you don't say what I learned in the kindergarten is wrong or called the primary school is wrong. You don't say. You go beyond it. So Ramanuja says, if you pray for material pleasures, like the bird looking for sweet fruits, You pray for promotion, wealth, and many such wonderful things to God with all sincerity, there is nothing wrong in it. As a result of sincere prayer or spiritual practices, praying for material pleasures, when you feel that God is listening to you, when your desires are, at least some of them are fulfilled, then out of a sense of gratitude to God, you continue the same prayer without looking for anything, without asking for anything. So there is a graduation, there is an evolution from prayer for some benefits to a higher prayer where you continue the same prayer without asking anything for it. Like now, at the second stage, you start practicing prayers, you start practicing your duties and responsibilities without any attachment, without any desire. That will gradually take you to immortality. So any kind of activity, spiritual practice, without any desire, will automatically will make you fit for jnana prapti. Karmanishthayaha chitta suddhi dvarena purushartha hedutum na swadantriyana jnana nishthadu swadantriyana purushartha hedhu anyana apeksha. This is a statement in Shankara's commentary. What it means is, any kind of practice, even if you help a man to cross the street or give a $5 bill to a poor homeless man sitting in the streets, or maybe after this if you help other volunteers to clean up this place, you are not getting anything, and nobody is photographing and putting your name in newspapers. You have done all this, so you can't, in fact, coming here you won't get anything. You get only some these ideas. So now you cannot look for anything, any selfish motive for any of these activities. Each and every one of these activity will remove one fraction of ignorance from your mind and will give a quantum leap to a higher level of spiritual evolution. That's a very important point to remember. Actions themselves will contribute to spiritual awakening. Any unselfish action, even an unselfish thought, can play a very important role in our spiritual evolution, spiritual awakening. It's called, Nishkama Karma. So, praying for material benefits, nothing wrong in it. It is a very important, very important point and serious misunderstanding as a background. The point is, you should either practice prayer without any desire or don't pray at all. It's like saying, I won't go to kindergarten, I will go only to Oxford or Harvard. No one is going to get education if a child ever refuses to go to kindergarten. No, I'm not kindergarten, only Harvard. You will remain in illiterate. So you have to start somewhere. So first of all, it's natural human instinct to begin spiritual practice with a definite purpose. Nothing wrong in it. And Krishna himself tells you, na buddhi vedam janiyet ajnanam karma sankinam. If you tell somebody who is working hard with a definite motive, definite purpose, with a definite plan, everything laid out, you should not have any plan in mind. You're totally wrong. Let him plan, have a definite motive, and work sincerely as an offering to God. After some time, he will plan all this without much selfish motive. Gradual evolution. That's an important point to remember. So nothing wrong in praying to God for whatever you want. Remember, people ask this question. Sri Ramakrishna didn't want Vivekananda to ask for anything. But we are not Vivekanandas. When I say this, people often get offended. Why Vivekananda could? Why not I? They don't ask this question in material life. Einstein is a great scientist. Why not I? Einstein worked very hard. So he became Einstein. So Vivekananda must have worked hard in the past life. So he became Vivekananda. He could not ask for anything. Even if he had tried, he could not. Psychologically, it was impossible for him to ask for anything. So it is totally wrong. It's like the example I gave, a guru asked his disciple, you bring a glass of water. Maybe in modern time, father may have asked his son, let us say. The son said, no, I won't bring you a glass of water. Because if I bring you a glass of water, there will be a selfish motive behind. So I won't give you a glass of water. The man, old man died of thirst. So we should start somewhere. Start from where we stand. And go forward. Nothing wrong. If a student is going to school, he can pray to God for getting a high grade. Nothing wrong in it. He should not try to imitate Vivekananda, who did not ask for anything. He asked for only for jnanam and bhakti. Nothing wrong. So he can't do that. It's an important point. Yeah.
So Maharaj, so of the two birds you are talking about, right, is the lower bird the Jivatman and the higher bird the Paramatman?
Yeah.
And what is the definition of those two?
The two birds, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I tell you. The bird sitting below is like the human beings who work hard, lot of success, efficiency, a good job, plenty of money in the bank, but frequently feels a kind of inner dissatisfaction, discontentment. Without that, it won't look upward and see the other bird. It be going on eating sweet and bitter fruits. It won't raise its eyes towards the other bird sitting above. So never and then it gets some blows, or it could some experience like reading a great book. It could be listening to a great idea. Then, as I mentioned earlier, you get a distant vision of something beyond, some higher transcendental ideal, which we feel we want to reach. All the devotees coming here, you find, they have in their mental horizon some higher spiritual ideal. It is this that actually sustains them. Because they are far above those who don't have this vision. They are like fish which has realized that it is caught in a trap, in a net. Be able to suck, get out of the net, into fall into water, that's a different question. But they are aware of the fact that there is something higher, something transcendental that may be desirable to reach. So that is a state that the bird sitting below belongs to that category. Human beings who have got some spiritual aspirations, who are sincere, but in the midst of all these things may not have already reached, but sincerely trying. And Vedanta tells, even an attempt, a very, very simple attempt in this life will help you to create a spiritual bank account. And that will come to your rescue, and that will help you in the next life. So, in the Krishna, Arjuna asked one question, Ayadi Sadhyo Pedo Yoga Chalidamanasaka Aprapa Yoga Sam Siddhim Kam Gadim Krishna Gachim. The question you are asking, what about those who work hard, who pray, but don't always succeed? Well, Krishna says, well, whatever you do, nothing will be lost. Naki Kalyana Kasi Durgadim Dada Gachim. Little bit of spiritual practice, even reading a book or some service connected to some spiritual institution or a temple, anything will create a spiritual bank balance in your name, and you'll be given a checkbook and a fountain pen. You can draw your check next life. And Krishna tells, Tatradam buddhi samyogam labhade paurodekhikam yadadeja tato bhuya samsiddho kurinantena. Then Krishna tells, with this bank balance, you are born again. See, Vedanta, this is a very important point to remember before you listen to Vedanta. The law of karma and the doctrine of reincarnation, yesterday I mentioned this very elaborately at the beginning itself, to be understood very clearly. Life doesn't end with death. Death is only a comma, or a semicolon at the most, not a full stop. So Krishna tells, Tatradam buddhisam yogam labhade pavodekikam. You have no freedom. If you have accumulated some spiritual capital, if that capital remains in your bank account, you can't escape. When you pass along the streets of San Francisco, you will be looking for some place where meditation or some spiritual practice are going on. Your buddhisam yogam, your accumulated samskaras and vrittis will force you. Karyadehi avashakarma, you are helpless. And I shall enter. Maybe your family members, no, don't go there, it's a waste of time. You go back, I shall go to the temple, then only I will come back, you will say. Because you are your own, it's an independent journey. Family connection is only the tip of the iceberg belonging to this life. Below the water level, there's a huge iceberg which is invisible. So you have accumulated the spiritual capital. By the force of that spiritual capital, you continue your spiritual journey. And in the next life, you are born with this checkbook and fountain pen, and you can draw your check and you can make use of your accumulated spiritual capital, vasana, samskaras and bhurtis, that will take you forward. That's an important point of Vedanta. Okay.
Swami, so this question is around the concept of work. So seems like if the Atman has to completely realize the ultimate Brahman, then it has to keep working. Like in any other field here.
Could you
also
repeat the question once more at the beginning?
Yes. So this question is around the concept of work.
Yeah.
So you told that like in any other field, if you want to completely realize the ultimate reality, the Atman has to work towards it.
Yeah.
In the spiritual path. And yesterday you also mentioned that the concept of Maya is not completely existent, but it's completely not even not non-existent.
Yeah.
So work seems like mandatory for Atman to realize the Brahman. Now,
there's a little confusion in what you say. Please continue.
Okay, so my question is, does this concept of work even apply to Brahman? Because if it does not, then who creates this Maya, which is supposed to be somewhat existent?
Yeah. Okay, anyway, but I shall first, there are a few small misunderstandings, not very serious, but very serious, of course. So the point is, first of all, Atman doesn't work and Brahman doesn't work. Those ideas are not coming to that. Now, what we call, what we are, we are nothing but Atman manifesting in association with this body, mind, intellect, accumulated samskaras, vasanas, purtis and so on. So we have to work out these accumulated tendencies, vasanas and vrittis. And first of all, we must evolve to the next stage. So making use of all our potential resources, we must do our duty. At the beginning, do our duty with all concentration. If we can't do without desire, then do with desire, with a definite motive, nothing wrong in it. Gradually, we will be able to do our duties and responsibilities, everything, without any desire. It may be not, may not be in this life, maybe next life. And then, gradually, when our mind becomes completely pure, then the realization that we are the Atman and not this body, and Atman and Brahman are the same thing, and this body, this embodiment, this association with mind and intellect, these are all secondary details. Our true nature is that we are Atman. That realization will come at the end of that journey. So when that comes, then we cannot really explain in words what that state will be. We will realize our true nature. People like Vyasa, we gave, or Vyasa, as I mentioned after reading, after writing the Bhagavad Purana yesterday. All these great sages who reached the highest experience continued working for the good of others, for the good of humanity. So there's a difference between their work for the good of humanity after the realization and their own work before they reach the realization. After reaching the highest realization, they didn't stop working, but a different perspective. So for spiritual seekers, even without waiting for the real experience to come, as a concept, we can practice. See, even we may not have actually reached that state of experience, still, even as a concept, it will help us to practice our duties and responsibilities without much concern. Once we have in our mental horizon a higher goal, a transcendental goal, as the bird sitting below on the branch below saw the other bird, so he got an idea there is a higher goal to be reached. There is a higher possibility. There is a transcendental possibility that I can aspire to reach, maybe not immediately, but after some time. That will help us to in our everyday life. So we should not try to think the Atman versus Brahman. Atman and Brahman is a and explain Maya. That should not be mixed up. Please remember that. There should not, these ideas, concepts should not be mixed up. Somebody asked the question about Maya. So I give that definition and explanations. So when it comes to individual life, first of all, we must try to enrich our mental system with spiritual food by reading scriptures, by contemplation, by associating with enlightened spiritual seekers, that will help us. And slowly we find we get a distant idea of a higher possibility. the other bird sitting above, that will take us towards itself.
Yeah. Swami, here. Yesterday you talked a little bit about intellect and mind. And in the, you know, Western world, everything is interpreted sort of intellectually. And people read a book and they think, I've got it, I understand, you know, what it's all about. But there's then that sort of higher level, which I think you meant when you, I guess, what I'm looking for is an explanation of how intellect and mind are different and related. Is it like intellect and experience? Are they related, or how are they different?
Okay, so I shall try to explain both metaphysically and psychologically. At a metaphysical level, Hindu metaphysicians define intellect as nischayatmika antakarna vritti. So, nischayatmika antakarna vritti, these desiderative faculties, cognition and decision making, take place at the intellectual level. You read a book, well, tomorrow I shall practice meditation 5 o'clock in the morning, every day. It's a wonderful idea. You have a sincere desire. You have made a decision. But then you actually start doing that tomorrow morning. Suddenly, well, tomorrow morning I have something else to do. Maybe I can do it tomorrow. So procrastination and postponement, or some kind of justification, which is actually the work of our internal mechanism, which actually shows we are not ready for it. Okay. No, there is no insincerity in your decision. You sincerely want it, no doubt about it. But something else, which is not unrelated to intellect, creates a mental block, a block rather, generally mental block. Who is blocking you? What is blocking you is mind. So, in Vedantic tradition, sankalpa vikalpatmika antakarna vritti is mind. Means, what it means is this: our system, mental system, has accumulated a lot of impressions, vasanas and vrittis, samskaras, impressions, so on. Some of them are good, some of them not so very good. So there's a conflict between them. Those impressions which are good will cooperate with your intellectual decision, I shall meditate. But there are stronger impressions which do not cooperate. Every action produces a vritti. Vritti becomes a samskara, vasana, and it is reinforced by the same identical actions. So Patanjali Yoga Sutra, you listen to that, you understand. So the whole point is, our mental system contains many impressions, many memories, many characteristics, which are not always very helpful. And of course, there is a store of good impressions which may be helpful. So this conflict takes place, and we do not always live at the intellectual level. We live at the mental level. Our actions are guided and determined by our innate accumulated impressions, samskaras and vrittis. Decision may help you at the physical level. See, when you come out of this temple, whether turn to the right or left, is a decision at the physical level. So, karmendriyas, you can have your decision. You can do. But you cannot be sure what thought is going to emerge in your mind next minute. You cannot decide. It's impossible. We cannot have a GPS system for the mind. We can have a GPS system for our body. So there is no predictability for mental functions. So what will you do? Go on accumulating positive samskaras through good actions, good thoughts, good associations. Positive vrittis, samskaras and vasana should be accumulated. Go on doing. Don't worry about, oh, I shall give water only if I am totally unselfish. We should not. I gave the example, somewhat ridiculous, that whole story. So no matter whether we are unselfish or selfish, just go on doing good things. Mentally, physically, intellectually, verbally. That will give you an accumulated storehouse of good samskaras. And that will reduce the conflict. So actions will produce a rich storehouse of good samskaras. And when the good samskaras become more dominant than bad samskaras, conflicts will go down. Otherwise, when people try to meditate, suddenly they feel like getting out of it because the dominant unhealthy samskaras are driving them away. On the other hand, people who can pray and meditate and naturally, instinctively take to good ideas because there is a good storehouse. It may be coming from previous life cycle or maybe from this life cycle. There is something there. So go on doing good actions, speaking good words, thinking good thoughts, and they will bring a good storehouse of positive samskaras that will reduce the conflict. You asked, wanted to ask something?
So,
okay. That's right. Yeah, now coming to the last one. Now okay. We already 10:30. Please come to the last.
So one question was that you mentioned earlier about having a checkbook and a fountain pen when you're born. Now, a lot of people, when they have the good bank balance, they like to invest it wisely and grow it. So how do they invest and how do they grow that thing in next life or whatever life they are in? How does it work in terms of spiritual context so that it can keep on growing and you don't lose your original investment that you had?
Yeah, that's true. You know, in fact, the force of previous samskaras will certainly take you forward through good actions. So yesterday I was mentioning this prarabdha karmas, you know. What your present life and all the actions we do are related, they are in a way manifestations of the samskaras, karma, phalas, the results of actions which have already started manifesting. It's called prarabdha, prakarshena arabdha. Means it's just like an arrow that has left the bow. Now, if we continue doing spiritual practices or good actions, the force of those good actions, spiritual practices, will always help us from maybe negative results of some negative prarabdha karmas. So, you know, as a strong wind blows, that Shankaracharya says, the arrow doesn't have to hit the target. The arrow only has to exhaust its velocity. That could be affected by another an obstacle may appear, or maybe a strong wind may blow. We may deflect the arrow so that it won't reach a target. God's grace can be in the form of an obstacle or maybe strong wind blowing. So spiritual practices will naturally make you graceworthy. So graceworthiness will help you even from negative prarabdha karmas. Some prarabdha karmas may be negative. The intensity will be reduced by spiritual practices, which again happens by what's called divine intervention in Christian mystical traditions, called God's grace in other traditions. So now we are already reached the end of time. Can you have an announcement paper? One flyer we can give? Yeah. So here's an announcement for you. So now, after this, we will have refreshments from 11:30 to 12 o'clock, and then from 12 to 12:30 meditation. So thank you for coming here and also for the questions. Yeah. Many of you may know that we have Sunday lectures every Sunday after the Christmas, this winter recess is over. Please look at the website, yesavedanta.org. We have Friday classes here, 7:30 to 8:30 Patanjali Yoga Sutras. So we deal with the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and also the important commentaries of Vyasa, Vijnana Bhikshu, Bhojya, Shankaracharya, Vivarana and all that. And then we have Sunday lectures every Sunday from 11 to 12 o'clock. So you can see our website. You can take copies of our bulletin you find in the flyer. Thank you. Namaskar.